Members, I'm going to call the meeting to order. And we're going to start with Representative Johnson's bill, House File 228. Somebody want to move the minutes from March 6th?
So moved.
Oh, Representative Lee moves the minutes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion adopted. And Representative Johnson moves House File 228 to be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. Representative Johnson, to your bill.
Madam Chair, committee, this bill involves a situation that happened in, Washington, Chisago, Anoka County area. It deals with arson fire, enhancing the penalties for large wildfire arson. What occurred was in the spring of 2009, I believe, wildfire arson was set in the Chisago or Carlos Avery Wildlife Refuge. That spring was an extremely dry spring, and turned out a member of the Forest Lake Fire Department actually set that fire along with a number of other ones at the same time, either using a bow with a flaming arrow or Roman candles. Large Roman candles to start these fires out in the grassy areas. The Forest Lake Fire Department, along with a number of other fire departments, were responding to fires that were threatening buildings and putting out these smaller fires, and the one inside the wildlife refuge got away, burning over 2,600 acres. The firefighter who set these fires was eventually caught and charged and convicted. It wasn't until afterwards, during the pre-sentence investigation, they learned that because he had no points and the size of the fire he set and no structures or buildings were damaged or destroyed, all he could get was on his felony conviction was probation. He later got into more trouble and violated the conditions of his probation, but by the time he was able to get back to Judge Maslow, the judge was able to do nothing because of the sentences already he was facing, that there was no extra time that he had served for the violations or for the fire itself. This fire, the personnel that ended up putting out this fire over multiple days consisted of over 120 fire units from well over a 30-mile radius of the fire, taking away assets to protect other citizens and other property well away from the Forest Lake area. There's over 200 firefighters that were involved, along with the National Guard with their helicopter and support crew, the DNR helicopter and the support crew. So it took a lot of assets to put this fire out, and the gentleman basically received nothing for a penalty for his conviction. This bill enhances the penalties, so if more than 500 acres are burned, you'll get some, and some buildings are threatened, he will get some jail time. But if it's a large enough fire over 1,500 acres or more than 100 buildings or dwellings threatened, and the way they were threatened is by having to be evacuate, then he'd receive a even stiffer penalty instead of getting nothing. It's also added into restitution, so if a firefighter gets hurt, and I believe at least one firefighter did get hurt fighting this fire, where restitution costs can be placed upon him for the cost of the injuries and the financial difficulties that the cities or the fire department have to ensure due to the injury.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Is there anyone here to testify in favor or in opposition to the bill? Are there questions from members? Seeing none, Representative Johnson moves House File 228 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, motion prevails.
Thank you.
Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, and I move that House File 838 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. Representative Schoen, to your bill.
Madam Chair, members, this bill is related to domestic fatality review teams, and this bill was heard in civil law the other morning, and I do have an oral amendment to the bill to get it in the shape I'd like to have it and make it non-controversial.
Representative Schoen, state your oral amendment.
On line 1.17, remove the underlined court services data under section 13.84.
And Representative Schoen, could you explain your oral amendment?
The other morning, it just there was some concern related to the amount of information that would be available, and quite frankly, after further discussion, the information we needed from court is already attainable, is what my understanding is. So it's just not needed, and it makes people feel better.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I didn't hear the amendment. If we could hear that again, that would be great.
On line 1.17, remove what the underlined words are, court services data under section 13.84.
Okay, thank you.
Are there any questions from members on Representative Schoen's oral amendment? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's not a question, just a comment, and thank you for doing that, and I think that's a good move to make, and I'll be supportive of the bill.
Thank you.
All those in favor of Representative Schoen's oral amendment to delete the new language on line 1.17 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Amendment is adopted. Representative Schoen, to your bill as amended.
Very briefly, Madam Chair, the reason that this is added is just adding for Department of Corrections and detention data. The domestic fatality review teams were having some difficulty with legal at Department of Corrections. I've discussed this with Department of Corrections. They have no problem with the bill. Absolutely understand what we're looking for and want to help in any way, because these teams are designed to review information related to domestic homicides and what we can do to prevent those in the future relating to gaining scientific data and moving that forward. It's a research-type team. So at this point, having this language in, and I think Representative Scott can also attain to this, that was very non-controversial. In fact, that was everybody was very supportive of adding that language as it stands now with the amendment.
All right, is there anyone in the audience that's here to testify for or against the bill? Are there questions from members for the author? Seeing none, I'll renew my motion that House File 838 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, motion prevails.
Thank you.
Thank you. Members, I believe that our committee administrator just went to find Representative Winkler so that we can hear his bill. So if you could just be patient for a couple minutes so we can move on.
Thank you.
Okay. Members, Representative Winkler is here to provide just testimony on House File 863. We're not going to take action on the bill today. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, the House File 863 is a campaign finance bill that was initially suggested by the Campaign Finance Board. It's been heard and passed in the Elections Committee. There are a couple of provisions related to civil penalties. And there's one other provision that's applicable to judiciary that I can't remember off the top of my head, but it's a relatively small footprint for judiciary. But we do have an amendment that, we can't put it on the bill because it's not here, so we'll do it later. So we'll just do the testimony. So, Mr. Goldsmith, I wonder if you could just give quick testimony on the judiciary elements of the bill.
Madam Chair, members, Representative Winkler, thank you. I will talk about just the first, the penalty items that are in the bill. And for that, the bill isn't actually before the committee, but if you have a copy of it, you can follow along. If you don't, I'll just talk about the penalties that are in the board's recommendations. And that would start on page 7. The board found, as you probably know, that in many cases, the treasurer isn't actually the record keeper for the committee. This is true in the case of state party units, caucus committees, gubernatorial committees, most really large committees. The treasurer doesn't have the hands-on role that your treasurer would have in your committee. And what the board found in one investigation, in fact, was that the treasurer, that staff members of the association involved were actually providing the treasurer with incomplete information. They knew it was incomplete. They provided it in the form of a report, a finance report for the treasurer to sign, and the treasurer, of course, signed it. And a complaint was filed. The board investigated that complaint, found those to be the facts. But because the statute relating to false certification only applies to the person who actually signs the report, no one was penalized, even though staff persons who had accepted this responsibility intentionally misled the treasurer. So what the bill would do is to extend the obligation for truthfulness to a person who provides information to a treasurer with the intent that the treasurer use that in certifying a report. And if a person provides that information knowing that it's false or knowing that it's incomplete, that person would be subject to the same civil penalty that the treasurer would have been subject to, which is a civil penalty of $3,000. So it's an existing civil penalty in the law, but would be applied to a slightly broader group of people, namely people that the treasurer trusts who are supplying the treasurer with information that he or she should be able to believe is truthful and accurate. The second change is relates to that same investigation, actually, and it's on page 8 at line 8.10 of the bill, if you happen to have that in front of you. If not, I'll just tell you there's a record-keeping requirement. Every committee has to keep records, and your treasurers all keep records. Surprisingly, to me, when I actually looked at it in detail, and it might surprise you to know, that if you fail to keep those records, there's no civil penalty, but you can go to jail. It's a gross, it's a misdemeanor. And I will tell you that nobody has ever gone to jail or even been charged with a crime for violation of Chapter 10A. The board has never referred a matter for prosecution under 10A. But the board was frustrated in this case where it found a complete lack of record keeping, and yet there was no penalty whatsoever. So the second recommendation is that that a civil penalty be established for the failure to keep appropriate records, and that be available for application against both the treasurer and anyone who has accepted the responsibility to do that record keeping, which in the case of a state party unit would be probably a finance director or finance officer. So that would be the second penalty. The third penalty arises in the new provisions for electioneering communications. It's a disclosure provision. It requires a statement, much like the reports that you file. Now, in the bill, the penalties are higher than they are in an amendment that Representative Winkler will be introducing tomorrow. It's already been amended in the Senate. And so the penalty for failing to file that statement would be exactly the same as the late filing fee that you would pay if you failed to file your campaign finance report. That's $50 a day up to $1,000. After that, the board has to send a certified letter telling you that you're still late. Of course, by that time, we've called and emailed several times. After that, an additional civil penalty of up to $1,000 can be imposed. And then finally, if a person actually refuses, in other words, willfully, and that means intentionally and with knowledge of the statute, still refuses to file, there could be a penalty of up to four times the disbursements that should have been disclosed. And so those are penalties that are consistent with the campaign finance penalties, but they're in this bill because it's a new area for disclosure. Representative Winkler mentioned, I think of the 211B provisions. There is one other item. I'm not sure if it relates specifically to this committee, but I'll mention it anyway. And that is back in 2011, and again this year, the board has recommended that it be given jurisdiction over three specific provisions of Chapter 211B. 211B is the Fair Campaign Practices Act, and the board doesn't have any jurisdiction over that act. That act is enforced, when it is, by the Office of Administrative Hearings, and only through the complaint process. Though OAH doesn't answer questions, issue advisory opinions, or look into matters. It only addresses complaints filed by complainants. The three provisions that we're looking for jurisdiction over are the provision that requires you to put a prepared and paid for disclaimer on your campaign material, and any association would have to do that. The provision that governs generally how money raised for campaign purposes can be used. And finally, the corporate contributions prohibition. We already have jurisdiction over the independent expenditure disclaimer that political committees and funds have to include. And so it's not much of an extension to give us a jurisdiction over the other form of disclaimer. We already have jurisdiction over campaign spending in the form of non-campaign disbursements, something that doesn't count against your spending limit. In fact, the board can recognize new categories that shouldn't count against your spending limit. And so it isn't much of an extension to allow us to have jurisdiction over regular spending as well. And finally, corporate contributions, the question that comes up before us most often, besides whether something is a corporate contribution or not, is what do I need to do if I want to put a sign on corporate property? How much do I have to pay? Do I have to pay anything? Do I have to have a written contract, and so on? In all three of these areas, we regularly get questions. We get lots of questions during the election cycle. and we try to answer them, but the only way we can do that is by pointing to the statute and saying, here's what it says. Essentially, you have to consult your own legal advisors or look at OAH cases if there are any, but we can't give you an authoritative answer, and that's not a good service to the people that we have to regulate. And so by giving the board jurisdiction over these three provisions, and it only is as they apply to candidates, committees, and funds who are already under our jurisdiction, you would be providing an authoritative source to get your questions answered, to have advisory opinions addressed when there are questions staff can't answer, and to ultimately to make administrative rules. And when I say administrative rules, people often get scared. But I want to give you an example. The prepared and paid for disclaimer says it has to be conspicuous. No one knows what conspicuous means. Nobody has the authority to define that. Those are the types of things that an agency should use administrative rulemaking for, not to expand the scope of the statute, but to clarify words that we sort of know what they mean, but nobody knows how many points of font you have to use. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And I know that there are at least two other people that want to be heard on this bill, so if we could bring them forward to provide their testimony, and then we can go to questions. As I stated, we're not taking action on the bill today. It's just an informational hearing. But if you're here to be heard on House File 863, if you could please come to the table.
Madam Chair.
Representative Drazkowski.
I wonder if Representative Winkler could, or maybe Mr. Goldsmith could point us. I was looking for that last part that Mr. Goldsmith was talking about in the bill. And I got the first two parts, but didn't catch up with them on the third.
Mr. Goldsmith.
Madam Chair, Representative, it would be Section 12 on 4.20, which actually gives the jurisdiction over those three provisions. Is that the question you were asking?
Yes.
Line 4.20 is where it begins. That gives the general jurisdiction to enforce those provisions, and then other sections, Section 11, gives investigation authority, and another section gives advisory opinion authority.
Thank you.
Thank you. And if there's anyone here that would like to be heard on the bill, if you could please come forward. If you could please state your name for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Andrea Rao, and I represent MCCL, Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life. And I apologize for being a little late. There's too many bills going on, so I'm sorry. MCCL does oppose the proposed regulations in this legislation on so-called electioneering communications because of the chilling effect that they would have on MCCL's ability to engage in grassroots issue advocacy. Issue advocacy groups are private organizations that provide a vehicle for average citizens to effectively participate in the political process by pooling their limited resources to enhance their individual voices. Additionally, issue advocacy groups exist to inform their membership on current events and legislative happenings related to the issues they represent. A quick reading of the legislation before you may lead you to believe that MCCL's communications would be exempt from the new regulations. Unfortunately, that is far from the truth. In fact, MCCL does not have the resources to often engage in large-scale television campaigns. Most of our communications are directed at our members. However, we do engage in smaller, community-related education on pro-life issues. Included in such education campaigns are county fair booths and issue education at churches and other community events. At times, we publish ads in newspapers or air radio ads. We certainly send letters to our members with information updates. Often, our issue-based education focuses on legislation that may take several years to pass the legislature. Such education does not end on the day a legislative session ends, but continues throughout the year. Based on the legislation before you today, if MCCL merely mentions the author of a bill or mentions a legislator while describing previous legislative action on a bill, we would be engaging in electioneering communications if we are doing so within the specified time frame. Even a fundraising letter to our members would constitute an electioneering communication. It has been suggested to us that the time frame is very limited, so it shouldn't have that much of an effect. But it is 3 months of the year. That's 25% of the year that this would be in effect. the disclosure requirements that would then be required may not be burdensome to wealthy individuals or associations who may have to report only a handful of large donors and a few large projects. But for a small organization like MCCL, which does not have a large staff, with the vast majority of donations being small amounts and being engaged in many small projects, the burden would be immense. In addition to the strain it would place on the organization, the law would also have a chilling effect on our donors to continue to contribute to MCCL if they wish to maintain their own privacy. Regardless of intent, it seems that the real effect of these burdensome reporting requirements is less to inform the public and more to deter citizens from publicly engaging in the issues of the day. For this reason, we respectfully urge the committee to reject this legislation. Thank you.
Are there questions from members for Ms. Rao?
Madam Chair, I would just like to make a quick comment that some of the concerns raised by Ms. Rao are addressed in the A13 amendment, which we will take up when we actually, when you have possession of the bill. Maybe not all, but some.
Are there questions from members for Ms. Rao? No. Is there anyone else in, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Rao, can you point to exactly, it's a very big bill, could you point to those sections that are of great concern to MCCL?
Representative O'Neill, there are a number, and as Representative Winkler said, there is an amendment, and I'm not sure, I haven't had a chance to actually see the amendment yet, and there weren't any back there when I went to go look for them. But there are a number of concerns. I don't even have the bill before me, but that really the entire section on electioneering communications is very troublesome. And I did sit down with Gary Goldsmith last week, and we talked through a few of the issues. He thought we made a few valid points and was going to offer, as I understand it, some changes based on that. But, for example, we talked specifically, I asked him about a fundraising letter. And I said, just throwing out a random example, because part of what was in there was that newsletters from organizations and other similar regular publications or something along those lines were exempt. And I said, well, what about a fundraising letter? We certainly do fundraising letters. At MCCL, we would consider that a regular standard thing that we send out to our members. And he said, no, that definitely would not be exempt. And so that would be one example. And we do a variety of communications with our members throughout the entire year, updating them on legislation on both the state and federal level and things that have happened legislatively. And it would really very much hinder our ability to do that simply because we wouldn't be able to keep up with the reporting requirements.
Follow-up, Chair? Oh, new Chair. Sorry. Representative O'Neill. Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Ms. Rao, as I'm looking at this, I believe you're referring to Section 34 on page 16, mm-hmm. and just looking through the amendment, just in quick looking at it, I don't see any reference to page 16, and maybe Representative Winkler, you could speak to specifically her concerns out of Section 34, and I don't see anything referenced in the amendment to that page or that section.
Representative Winkler, I apologize. I was presenting a bill in another committee. So are we keeping it very narrow to the issues before the judiciary, or Representative Winkler?
Well, Madam Chair, that's my hope, but you control the questions, I don't. So I would just say that I think if you look at the amendment lines 3.19 to 3.22, it gets to the point about the type of electioneering communications have to be basically typical campaign-type communications, literature, mail, that kind of thing, as opposed to organizing at a county fair, which would be different. There is, we certainly had ample time for discussion about electioneering communications in the elections committee, but I understand that there are concerns that come up as we go along, and it may be more helpful to do that as we actually adopt the amendment to the bill.
Have we not adopted the amendment to put the bill?
We don't have the bill yet.
All right. Thank you, Representative Winkler. Representative Drozdowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So to that point that Representative Winkler made, is there anything in the amendment that has relevance to the purview of this committee?
Representative Winkler.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Drozdowski, it does, because a lot of these issues that we're talking about deal with, they affect the way civil penalties will be applied. And so it does in that sense, and it would therefore affect the scope of the type of civil penalties and who would be responsible for them. I would also like to just point out, I guess, that to the extent, you know, MCCL is testifying here today on this bill, a lot of the things in this amendment are to deal with concerns that her organization has had. So we can have this discussion here because she's here. That's my point of view.
Representative Drozdowski.
Well, Madam Chair, I just wonder whether there are fines or other penalties within the amendment that apply to the courts, or whether they're within the purview of the Campaign Finance Board, and if so, it may not be our committee that needs to attach the amendment or should properly be the one to consider it.
Representative Drozdowski, it's my understanding that this is the last committee stop for this bill, and as we attempt to make certain that bills are in tip-top shape before they go to the floor, as we discussed yesterday, I'm attempting to address the issues that are that come up. Representative Drozdowski.
Well, I appreciate that, Madam Chair. The thing is, our committee, if it doesn't have purview over election-related content, and that's, as I can see, the content of this particular amendment, that maybe it should make another stop back to Elections Committee before it goes to the floor, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Drozdowski. Further questions from members? All right.
Madam Chair.
Representative Drozdowski.
I did have some notes when Mr. Goldsmith was talking earlier. I've got to find the page now. And Madam Chair, Mr. Goldsmith, Section 15 of the bill, the first of the three sections you were talking about that had relevance to committee, I just wonder, you know, the language on 7.26 through 7.28, how does that play out there? It reads, an individual shall not knowingly provide false or incomplete information to a treasurer with the intent that the treasurer will rely on that information in signing and certifying to be true a report or statement. I'm just wondering how that would play out with your agency. Will you get into a he said, she said thing here? The other part of that question, are volunteers contractually bound? How can volunteers be bound? Because volunteers come and go in political campaigns, and they may maybe one volunteer that delivers the envelope of the checks, and that's the only volunteer activity they are involved in.
Mr. Goldsmith.
Madam Chair, Representative Drozdowski, first of all, as to how it would play out, the board regularly deals with questions of false certification, although now, of course, it's limited to the treasurer, and the question is, what did the treasurer know at the time he or she signed the report? Typically, we don't find false certification. When we have found it, it's been in cases where the treasurer has either taken or borrowed money and not included it on a report or used money for personal purposes. And those questions are fairly clear when we question the treasurer about the report. With respect to a volunteer, the person would have to be in a position where they are providing information to the treasurer on which the treasurer should be relying on. I'm sure we can think of hypotheticals where the language might not fit as well, but the intent of the statute is to bring in those people who are designated by the treasurer as the people they trust, finance directors of party units, and others in paid staff positions typically, who do the work and put the paper in front of the treasurer to sign. I don't think that the board would be looking at, in fact, I know the board wouldn't be looking at somebody handing the treasurer checks. That's the treasurer's job to determine the information surrounding those checks. But it's in the preparation of a report, which is our concern.
Other questions from members?
Madam Chair.
Representative Drozdowski.
Well, back to that point again, I wonder if introducing the additional language about an individual also having responsibility here develops that ping pong back and forth between the treasurer and a multitude of volunteers who, who knows what the situation could look like, and there'd be a lot of different hypothetical situations, but the way volunteers work, at least with the campaigns I'm aware of, Mr. Goldsmith, I just can see that language there might be problematic. I don't know if there's any better ideas there. The other question I had, Madam Chair, Mr. Goldsmith, is on page 8, under section 16, the question would be, where does that money go? Does that go to the Campaign Finance Board, or where does it go?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Madam Chair, Representative Drazkowski, to your second question first, all civil penalties, late filing fees, go into the general fund of the state. The board never bases its judgment of the amount of a penalty on anything other than the offense itself, and it doesn't benefit from the amount of penalties assessed. I would just like to touch on your previous point about the individual providing false information. The word knowingly is included there, and that would mean the individual must know that the information is false or incorrect, and must intend that the treasurer will rely on that false and incorrect information. So an inadvertent mistake would not be covered.
All right, further questions from members? If not, we had one more testifier we think that wanted to testify, and that is... Was there anyone else in the audience who wished to testify for or against this bill? Please come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Hilmberger. I'm CEO of Minnesota Family Council, a 501c4 issue advocacy organization, and Minnesota Family Institute, a 501c3 educational organization. And we have very serious concerns about this legislation, especially the electioneering communications portion of it, as well as another aspect that has to do with the disclosure of underlying sources for ballot questions. First, in its original form, our gravest concern was about the impact of the bill on 501c3 nonpartisan voter guides. But I see that the amendment that's before the committee now seems to address that issue the way the Senate, or a similar manner to what the Senate did in the bill there. And that seems to have addressed the 501c3 nonpartisan type of voter guide. But that leaves two areas about which we are still very concerned. One is 501c4 issue advocacy, voter education, that in the form of issue advocacy, where candidates are identified and their records are identified, and the materials involved will assist the reader in understanding the impact of a particular vote from the perspective of from an issue advocacy perspective. So, for example,
Mr. Helmberger, I'm going to interrupt you for just a minute. Can you tell me how that relates to the issues that we would deal with in the Judiciary Committee and not re-testifying on what took place in elections? Mr. Helmberger.
Probably not.
Okay. Because we don't want to rehear all of the election issues.
Okay.
So, Mr. Helmberger, so if you just want to wrap up.
Then let me cut to one other thing that may be of concern to this committee, and that is the effect for the disclosure of underlying sources to an association that contributes to a ballot question a campaign, or contributes from its general funds, I should say, to a ballot question campaign or to an independent expenditure committee or fund. And in particular, we're talking about donors who make undesignated contributions to the general fund of an organization. They do not direct the use of those funds. And under the provisions of the bill, if their contribution accounts for a large enough percentage of the association's, or if their contribution could be construed under the bill's, the mandated prorating methodology, if it could be construed as providing a large enough percentage of the association's contribution to, say, a ballot question, that donor of an undesignated contribution to the association's general fund will be identified as having contributed to the ballot question, when the donor did nothing of the kind. The donor made an undesignated contribution to an organization that does a variety of activities, but this legislation would falsely impute intent to the donor, for which that donor may very well, upon being disclosed, and that disclosure report being used as a target list by hostile opposition, that donor may very well be exposed to threats, intimidation, actual harm, not only to themselves personally, but to family members, to their business, or to their employees, depending on the type of donor we're talking about. And I mean, there is a serious moral aspect to this requirement that has to be considered.
Thank you. And Representative Winkler, is any of that taken care of with the amendment? Representative Winkler?
Madam Chair, the amendment does not directly address a lot of those concerns. I mean, the point, we don't need to get into this. We're talking about disclosing the sources of funds that are used to influence elections. That's what the issue is here.
All right. Further questions from members? All right. Seeing none, thank you, Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair? Just curious if this bill's been to state government finance yet.
Representative Winkler, has this bill been to state government finance?
Madam Chair, it has not, which is, I think it has to go there, not to the floor after this committee.
Okay. So, Representative Drazkowski, it will be going to state government finance. So we'll be...
Thank you.
We will be taking up this bill tomorrow so that it can pass to the next committee so that they can do additional work. All right. So with that, Representative Winkler, I don't have possession of the bill, so I can't lay it over. But why don't we move on to House File 1135, Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just switching gears slightly from campaign finance to child testimony. I guess, first of all, 1135 has not been moved, so maybe if there would be a member who'd be willing to move the bill.
Certainly. Representative Winkler, the chair will move that House File 1135 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Is that sufficient, Representative Winkler?
Madam Chair, well, I hope so.
All right. Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, members, the bill before you, House File 1135, seeks to protect children from further harm. As you know, in cases involving abuse of children, the testimony of a child is essential both in criminal and in civil matters. I would like to just point out at the beginning that in criminal matters, the child is not a party to the lawsuit. The child is a witness and is the victim of the alleged crime. In a civil matter, the child is likely, or maybe, it depends, may technically or not be the party to the lawsuit, but certainly is not the one choosing to bring the matter to court. And as such is yet again essentially along for the ride and is subject to whatever manner of harm that may ensue from a child being forced to confront a person who may have done something very horrible to them, or simply the challenge of a child testifying in open court with all kinds of people looking at them in a very unfamiliar setting. I think it raises questions about the reliability of the testimony. And I think this is a question of protecting a victim from being re-victimized. So the bill basically does a few things. It allows a child to bring a comfort item to the bench while testifying. It allows a supportive person to be near the child while testifying. And it allows the court to impose other conditions or limitations on the testimony that the child is offering to make this experience for them less painful. I would just highlight for you that in all these matters, both sides of the matter, both parties have an opportunity to rebut presumptions, and the court has substantial discretion in making sure that no party is unfairly prejudiced as a result of the protections that are embodied in this law. So, Madam Chair, I would urge your support, and I do have one testifier who would like to say a few words.
Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Hi, I'm Marcia Milliken. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Children's Alliance. And we are, our coalition represents children's advocacy centers that investigate child sexual abuse cases and ensures that children receive the services, the follow-up services that they need. Hundreds of children testify in court every year, and frequently they are asked to recount painful and traumatic events in front of a room full of strangers. As stressful as this experience can be for adults, imagine how it affects children. Under the current law, child witnesses are treated much like adult witnesses. They are expected to promise to tell the truth using the same oath as adults. They are expected to respond to complex questions asked by attorneys within a legal system they don't fully understand. The Child Witness Testimony Bill clarifies the court's authority to meet the special needs of child witnesses, which will ultimately reduce the stress and trauma they experience in court. There are five provisions in this bill. It allows the court to administer an oath to the child that the child understands at a developmentally appropriate level. You know, children are capable of promising to tell the truth. The important thing is to make sure that they understand what they're being asked to do. It allows the court to tell the child witness that it's okay to let the court know if they have any questions or they don't understand something. Children aren't raised to question authority, and so they often need that permission to know that it's okay. It allows the court to schedule a child's testimony at a time that's best for a child, when their attention span is at its best, when they have the highest level of energy. It allows for the comfort item for them to take one, for example, a blanket or a small toy, and it allows for a support person, which is already provided for in statute, to sit near the child witness when they're testifying. As Representative Winkler said, with each of these provisions, the court maintains discretion as to whether they grant these motions. And just in conclusion, I'd like to say that, you know, we've recognized that juvenile defendants deserve special considerations and accommodations and shouldn't be tried in adult court. Why wouldn't we recognize the child witnesses also require special accommodations, especially when they testify in adult court?
Thank you. I just want to see how many of in the audience want to testify in this bill, just so I can judge for time. Just one? All right. Questions? Representative Moline.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to Representative Winkler or the testifier. Just because I don't know the answer to this, and I don't know that it's in the bill, but how does the subpoena process work for a child? Is the child subpoenaed to testify, or are the parents? And who's required that the who is, I guess, required to make sure that the child appears at a hearing?
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative Moline, I don't have any idea, frankly. I've never subpoenaed a child, and I don't have any experience doing that.
Representative Lash.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Moline. The adult is subpoenaed with the subpoena deuces tecum, which means they produce the item, in this case the child, and they have the responsibility to bring the child to court.
All right, other questions from members? Otherwise, we'll call up the next testifier. Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler. I see you're talking about a child, and most of the stuff in this bill deals with a small child. I'm just wondering, how come you have the age of 18 and not... I've been in court with many juveniles that are age 14, 15, 16, 17, and they've had no problems in court. I'm just wondering why you use the term a child under the age of 18 when most of the stuff in this bill deal with children, which I believe are 13, 12, 10, in that range.
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, and Representative Johnson, I don't know if Ms. Milliken wants to weigh in on this, but I think the point is that there is substantial discretion that the court has to determine what's appropriate based on the circumstances, and certainly not all 16 and 17-year-olds are alike. And there may be a difference between those who have experience in the court system at that age and those who are here for the very first time, because remember, they are the ones who are at least the alleged victims of the crime.
And I would agree that... there is no age specification, but we do talk about developmentally appropriate. So that can apply to older children as well as younger children.
Members, I'm going to call up the last testifier, and then we'll take questions. So I saw there was one person who wanted to testify in the audience. If you'd please come to the table, state your name for the record, and then go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Max Keller, M-A-X-K-E-L-L-E-R. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Criminal Defense Lawyers, and I am a criminal defense lawyer. I've been an attorney for over 15 years, practicing in criminal law for that entire time. The MACDL does oppose this bill. We believe that it is unconstitutional for two reasons. It violates the right to confrontation under cases such as Crawford versus Washington, and it violates the separation of powers. The title of the bill says child witness testimony. Testimony, rules for testimony are procedural. That is something that would be subject to the evidentiary rules. That's a procedural rule. It's not substantive, and procedural rules are subject to the sole regulation of the judicial branch, not the legislative branch. In addition, this bill will place an undue burden on prosecutors to defend convictions that will come from this law when they didn't need the law in the first place, and the result is going to be that convictions are going to be tossed out because the law is going to be found to be unconstitutional, and then those people have to be tried again. And there's clearly many parts of this that are very vague. The previous testifier said, well, there's things that are up to the court's discretion. Of course, the provisions say the court shall do this, the court shall do this, and then, of course, it says, well, unless the court finds such and such. So there clearly is a presumption, as Representative Winkler said, there's a presumption, that was his term, that certain things are going to be done. It may be up to the court's discretion, but we are against this. We believe it's unconstitutional and it's unduly vague.
Thank you. Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had, I think I was kind of questioning some of the same things about that. Line 1.2, it says, shall administer an oath to the child in a manner that allows a child to understand the duty to tell the truth, etc. I'm just wondering, is there's got to be a place in statutes that outlines what the oath is and how it's applied to an adult. Are we creating, by inserting this, conflicting statutes for which is going to provide complications in our court system? And then the question about what the oath would be, do we give complete latitude? Does the judge just say, you know, say I promise? Or, you know, there's absolutely no guidelines there. And you may have every judge giving different, requiring the application of different oaths. So maybe that's some of what the testifier was leading on to, but I see some problematic parts there.
So was there a question, Representative Druskowski?
Just a comment, apparently. I thought it was a question and turned into a comment. I apologize, Madam Chair.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Keller, can you state why do you suggest that this bill deals with solely procedural matters that fall under the jurisdiction of the courts?
Well, thank you for that question, Representative Lesh. It doesn't change substantive law. It doesn't change the definition of any offenses, such as criminal sexual conduct or any other offense. It's purely procedural, in my understanding, in that it's talking about the oath. Clearly, that's something that it's up to the court to administer its oath, and very specific details about when someone's going to testify, like a child should testify only during the child's regular attendance hours at school. That's totally procedural, and that's totally within the discretion of the court, and the legislature has no business dictating that to the court. That's something about how the court runs its own business. The legislature would no sooner want the courts to tell the legislature when it could meet or when it could take testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Keller, can you tell me, do you think that it's in any way the purview of the legislature to dictate to the courts the order of final argument?
Mr. Keller.
Well, that's a subject outside of this bill, but it's been our position in the past that that is something that, similarly to what we're talking about, that is a procedural question that clearly based on a precedent, that's something that is only within the purview of the judicial branch, not the legislative branch.
Okay. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Question. It's not a question. It's a comment. I understand Mr. Keller's reservations. That line is regularly blurred around here, not just by the legislature, but also by the courts when they decide which matters are criminal and which are not criminal, which they have done with the payables list. So I just think it's a little bit more gray.
Sure, and I understand
final statement,
what you're
Representative
saying.
Winkler.
Well, Madam Chair, I guess my final statement in reaction to this is simply that I don't think there is a Sixth Amendment right to confront an issue that is raised in this legislation. In fact, a lot of other states go much further than that in protecting child testifiers. And, you know, there's nothing in here that prevents a defendant from being able to be in open court and listen to the testimony and to cross-examine the witness and everything else. It's simply changing the circumstances under which that takes place.
Thank you, Representative Winkler. With that, the chair lays over House File 1135 for possible inclusion in the Judiciary Policy and Finance Committee. Thank you, Representative Winkler. All right, next, Representative Mahoney, House File 1214. The chair moves that House File 1214 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. Oh, excuse me, Transportation Policy. Representative Mahoney.
One more stop. Hopefully we can get through there.
Hopefully we can get through this, Representative Mahoney.
Yes. Madam Chair, I am not entirely sure. We'll leave one chair because there's somebody else coming, I'm sure.
And Representative Mahoney, don't you have an amendment?
I do have a delete all amendment.
All right, the chair moves the DE1-2 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Mahoney.
Just a few opening comments, and then I will turn it over to the testifiers. I think many people know that this is a bit of a contentious bill.
Right, and Representative Mahoney, we don't want to talk about the whole bill.
Correct.
We would like to talk about the areas that are within our jurisdiction.
I would expect that to be, and I will take the chair's lead, starting on page 7, line 13, automated property system, and then get to 8.8, which is the criminal penalties. And I will skip the automated record keeping and just go to the penalties if that's all you want. Happy to do that.
Go ahead, Representative Mahoney.
Anyhow, members, Madam Chair, this is a contentious bill. It almost passed last year. We brought it to the Public Safety Committee just last week and heard loud and clear from the members, and I think the advocates both sides heard loud and clear from me that I do not want to bring this bill to the floor unless there is agreement that it does what it says it does, what it is intending to do, without overburdening the scrap dealers, the people we're trying to regulate, and it also gives the county attorneys and the police officers the ability to actually recover and prosecute car thefts, recover cars and prosecute the thieves. So, having said that,
Representative Mahoney, who's your testifier?
I will just say this on page 8, line 8, criminal penalties. It creates the I'll put my glasses back on and read it. A scrap dealer or an agent, or an employee, or a scrap metal dealer who is convicted of violating the section a second time within a period of 5 years is guilty of a gross misdemeanor. A scrap dealer, employee, blah, blah, blah. Convicted of violating this section a third or subsequent time within a period of 5 years is guilty of a felony and may be sentenced to imprisonment for not more than 3 years or to pay a fine of not more than $5,000 or both. And this is in addition to other remedies provided by law. That's what I believe is in your committee for. And I will turn it over to the testifiers, and hopefully they will say they are continuing to work to come to agreement.
Madam Chair.
Representative Portman.
I have a question for Representative Mahoney. The part of the bill that's properly before this committee is this criminal penalty section, and you're referring to another section of the bill. It's saying, you know, if somebody violates this section, they're guilty of a gross misdemeanor. what would a violation constitute? I mean, I think we have to talk enough about what comes before the criminal penalty to understand what it is a person would do wrong in order to get the criminal penalty for me to understand whether I'm for it or against it.
And Representative Mahoney, the other section actually is the 325E from section 2.27 to 2.32. So that's all. Representative Mahoney.
Well, Madam Chair, I think there's more than enough attorneys at this table to deal with the stuff. Those particular questions, I just play one at the Capitol. So I would, at this particular time, turn it over to County Attorney John Choi and Paul Cassidy.
Welcome to the welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is John Choi, the Ramsey County Attorney. I want to thank Representative Mahoney for bringing this bill forward. Also, Representative Sheldon Johnson, who also worked on this bill last year. The Delete All Amendment that is before you represents the law enforcement community's best attempt to try to resolve the differences that are on with respect to this bill, and we're continuing to work on those issues. I really do believe that we will get to a place where we will have resolution on all of the contentious issues, but as it relates to this particular committee, and I think to your point, Representative Hortman, what we're trying to address here is basically this issue became kind of near and dear to me after talking to a number of crime victims, and what we have found is that there were a number of cars that were stolen in St. Paul, and what was shocking to me was that there were people stealing cars literally out of people's driveways, and they were towing them or stealing them and just driving them to the scrapyard. And so a good working automobile was being scrapped within a matter of hours. And it just caught my attention because a lot of these individuals, the cars that were being stolen were older models and they're heavier. And a lot of these individuals are poor, so they don't have the comprehensive automobile insurance, so they are out of a car. And so what we found was that the current law basically has is that, you know, if it's 6 years or older, you don't have to prove you own the car by offering the title. And we looked at a number of other issues, and we felt that although there are criminals out there who are committing these crimes, that the industry also bears some responsibility in the solution. And so what we have put together is a very comprehensive way to go about kind of addressing some of the loopholes that we found. And then in addition to that, from Sherbourne County, Representative Zerwax, they've also had issues with scrap metal theft. Farm irrigators are being stolen out of the farms, and so we're trying to address that issue as well. And so this Delete All Amendment tries to incorporate all of those issues, yet trying to work with the industry. Now, we still have some issues related to disputes in the bill, but I really do believe over the course of between the time that we have to vote on this bill on the House floor, the Senate floor, that we will get all of these issues worked out so that you as legislators don't have to make the difficult choice of choosing between your sheriff and your police chief and your local scrapyard. And so our intent here is not to hurt the industry, and so we want to work with the industry to get to address those issues. Now, the issue that's before this committee, which is Section 10, and if there's another one, I can speak with it, but I wasn't aware that there was any issues beyond Section 10 of the bill, which relate to the criminal penalties. And what we have done is basically copied the approach that is taken in Wisconsin. Basically, they have a graduated response in terms of their regulations. So the first violation is a misdemeanor, second one's a gross misdemeanor, and the third would be a felony. And then any violation of anything in this chapter would be deemed to be a misdemeanor is how I would understand it.
Members, there is not a final fiscal note. There is only a preliminary fiscal note. And according to the sentencing guidelines, there between 2009 and 2012, there was only one existing misdemeanor conviction. And so in order for sentencing guidelines to really get into the whole ranking and have it start really impacting anyone's budget, a felony would be three. And so there's not a final fiscal note, but that's the preliminary assumptions. Representative Hortman.
Thank you. I have a question for Mr. Choi.
Representative Hortman.
I don't know what the right title is for the county attorney. I suppose there is probably one. Mr. Choi, so what would constitute a violation? What I see in the early part of the bill is a reporting requirement. And I'm thinking this in the practical terms of somebody who just spent the last 10 years working at John's Auto Parts in Blaine. And the reporting requirements in here of daily telling, you know, this system who you've bought cars from off the street. And so I'm wondering if we had 2 days in a row where one of our employees forgot to transmit the data, if that person is guilty of a gross misdemeanor for failing to put in some database the name and address of somebody we purchased a car from.
Mr. Choi.
Madam Chair and Representative Hortman, the current law today actually sets it up that a violation of these provisions would be a misdemeanor crime. What is new is that we're adding the graduated penalty. In other words, if it's your second offense, third offense. Now, please keep in mind that there really aren't many prosecutions of scrapyards or scrap dealers at all. In fact, I think the benefit of this bill is in the other provisions, quite frankly, in terms of actually making a difference around the issue of auto theft and doing good for the victims of people who have gotten their car stolen as it relates to the APS provisions and some other things that we've been working on.
Representative Hortman.
Madam Chair, Mr. Choi, my concern is that there's a few bad actors in this arena who are kind of known wrongful actors in the towing industry and in the scrap industry. And my concern is that we not put something in place that's very burdensome for everybody when the few bad actors are the ones that really are the problem. And, you know, I get concerned when a reporting requirement could send somebody in for criminal penalties. The second concern, and maybe you or Mr. Cassidy might be planning to address this, is the holding provision. I know last year's bill required folks to hold on to cars for a really long time, which at a gigantic operation like John's Auto Parts with 18 acres, this is not a big deal. But for little family businesses, it's a really big deal to hang on to cars for a long period of time, considering that 99.9% of the people who are in this industry are honest and upright and don't have any problems.
Mr. Choi.
Madam Chair.
Attorney Choi, sorry.
And Representative Hortman, thank you for that question on the holding period. And we've moved considerably. When this bill was introduced last year by Representative Carol McFarland and Representative Sheldon Johnson, we started out with a 30-day holding period. And we recognized over time that in learning more about the industry, I actually did a tour of a scrapyard, and we recognized that that probably is not feasible. And so we've got now the delete all amendment that is now before you is significantly different. In fact, with respect to cars with title, if you come in with a title, there's no hold period. And we had proposed 5 days in the original bill. So the delete all addresses that. And then if you don't have a title, if you can't prove that you own the title, then you have to sign under penalty of perjury a document saying that you do own the vehicle. And then there's a proposal of a 5-day hold period. That's something that the industry does not want. They want no hold period. And, of course, the reason why law enforcement, that hold period is so important is because we believe we need time to catch up with this crime, because what we found was within a matter of hours, these cars were being destroyed. And so then if you don't have insurance to replace that vehicle, you are out of vehicle. And so we're negotiating on that, and I do believe and maybe Paul can address it, but I do believe that we will come to some agreement on that. But the industry doesn't want a hold period. We think that we do need to have a hold period. But I think there are other provisions in the bill that we think are really good, like, for instance, the automated property system. And the reporting of that stuff will be real time. So I think that will be very helpful. There's some other discussions that we're having, and I know that we'll get there.
If we could just actually have Mr. Cassidy's testimony. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Madam Chair, members, Paul Cassidy with the law firm of Leonard Street and Dinard. We represent the Institute of Scrap Recycling Industries, better known as the scrap yards in your communities. We've been working closely with County Attorney Choi for probably well over a year talking about this issue, working with Representative Mahoney. I thank them very much for taking our ideas and our concerns into consideration. A number of things I just want to point out, first and foremost, is that 6 years ago, we did pass a scrap metal theft bill in the Minnesota legislature. It was carried by Representative Gardner and passed into law that year. That has a number of reporting requirements, many of which you'll see in this bill in the current law language. We think, first and foremost, those laws should be enforced and enforced vigorously, and we think a lot of this can get cleaned up that way. Number two, a new issue has arisen, and that is the issue that County Attorney Choi has unearthed in the past couple of years, and that's auto theft with basically a willing tow truck driver and a willing scrapyard that was willing to take the cars in, and it's become a problem. What we'd like to do is make, number one, our working with law enforcement work better. We'd like it to be more efficient, so we've agreed to continue talking with County Attorney Choi and trading offers, and a couple of things we already do. We already report VIN numbers and vehicle information both to the state of Minnesota and to the federal government. This bill asks us to yet do one more report, and that is to report all of our purchases to the automated pawn system that some of you may or may not be familiar with. I think the path we're going down is to make all three of those into one, so it's more efficient. So when businesses do take in a car, or when businesses do take in a bucket of scrap metal, that information goes into the automated product system or
property.
I'm used to the pawn system, but property system, and one button gets pushed so that the auto vehicle information gets sent to the proper authorities at DPS, at NMVITIS, which is the national reporting system, and then also into the automated property system where law enforcement can actually have an efficient way of looking at that information almost in real time. Finally, I would say, getting back to the issue of holds, that has been a big issue of contention not only here but around the country with scrap yards and law enforcement. It's a very expensive process, and Representative alluded to it earlier that a lot of yards just aren't that big, and if you go to a scrap yard in the urban areas, they're very small, and just to hold even five cars for a five-day period, much less 30, costs them money. It also becomes very dangerous. We have one scrap yard that County Attorney Choi is familiar with that they actually flatten their cars as soon as they get them in, so that kids and homeless folks don't get hurt in, because people, you know, jump fences at scrap yards and play around there at night. So anyway, I think we're making progress. We are trading offers. We've been working very hard the last couple of days redrafting legislation, and I think we're in the right direction. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, and members, again, Section 2 with the injunction is within the district court as well. And so that was the other piece that this committee has jurisdiction over do either of you have any comments that you'd like to make on Section 2?
And Madam
County
Chair,
Attorney Choi.
This provision is one that's very important to me. And what this does is that it just incorporates, it takes existing law and allows for the regulation under 325E to be included.
Questions from members? Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? All right, seeing none. Whoop, Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to echo Representative Hortman's comments. You know, and I understand we're looking primarily at Section 10 of the bill, the penalties, and the other two sections that you, Madam Chair, have outlined. We're looking at these transaction records, and if, as I understand it, if they don't include the date, time, and place of receipt of scrap metal purchased or acquired and a unique transaction identifier, the full name, residence, address, primary telephone number, and accurate description, including sex, height, weight, eye color, hair color, and, if known, race. So if we leave out the eye color, I guess. Mr. Choi, I'd be curious, and then, I mean, the next item, too, amount paid, the number of the check. I'd be curious if any of these one items are left off of one of these transactions, which are required, as I read the bill, to be a part of a permanent record. So if one is lost, obviously, they are subject to, on a second offense, a gross misdemeanor. So if the individual business doesn't write the eye color of somebody they bought a pile of scrap metal from, are they subject to a gross misdemeanor if they do it twice?
County Attorney Choi.
Madam Chair and Representative, one thing to keep in mind is that prosecutors are ministers of justice, and it would be inappropriate, I think, to pursue a criminal prosecution just because someone left out the eye color of a reporting requirement. So I think one thing you have to keep in mind is that there's discretion involved, but doesn't mean that because there's a technical violation of statute that it necessarily merits prosecution. And that's an important principle, our ethical principles as a prosecutor. And so that would be, I think, and I stand for election, so that would be an embarrassing thing for any prosecutor to pursue.
So, Mr.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Choi, you're saying trust us. I understand.
Is there a question there, Representative?
I have a question actually for Representative Mahoney, and that is Representative Mahoney. Where, and maybe the three of you. I understand that Representative McFarland worked intently on this bill the last session, and worked and developed what was understood to be a compromise, but it didn't go anywhere. Two questions. One is the first question is does this DE amendment represent that compromise? And the second question is, why didn't we start off from there?
Representative Mahoney.
Madam Chair, to your first question about discretion, I suspect if somebody charged someone for not getting the color of the eyes, he or she would be in the same boat as the person that is charging an Alzheimer victim with voting twice. And the internet blew up over that one, which was kind of fun to watch. We started off with a new bill. We did take the old or last year's compromise and tried to work with it. They wrote the bill. The county attorney wrote the bill. The scrap dealers have responded, and that's where we are at the delete all amendment. I'm sure that whenever you start over again, knowing you're going to have to negotiate, you put a few things in, and that's where I think they started with this bill this year. At this particular point, there's a lot of that stuff out, and the law enforcement still believes at this point that this is a bill that will make it simpler for them to recover cars and to slow this growing industry. Two blocks from me, they had almost $60,000 worth of copper stolen, and I don't think it's been recovered, but I was pretty sure it was all melted down within a couple of hours of it being stolen. And there was over 400 kids that didn't get to start skating on ice for an extra month and a half.
Okay, members, we technically have 3 minutes left of committee. We have two people left on the list with questions, and we still have one more bill to do. So, County Attorney Choi.
If I could just address that one question that Representative Drazkowski had about the last year's bill. Actually, the last year's bill, I think the industry would, and Paul, you can speak to it, but it was a 15-day hold period. So it's actually worse. And so this, I think, and I think a lot of credit goes to John Elder from the Minneapolis Police Department, who I think had a great moment where we had a meeting, and I think the industry got to understand a little bit about what the automated property system could do for business as it relates to some of their reporting requirements. And so I think this bill, there's different parts of it, but yes, we were kind of close last year, but that bill was not, there was also a 15-day hold period, so that was something that was really non-negotiable for them.
Representative Moline.
Quick question, Madam Chair, and to Mr. Choi or the author, are there any parameters for what qualifies, I guess, as a motor vehicle, whether it be age or condition of the vehicle? I represent a very rural district where sometimes people have vehicles sitting on their back 40 for years, and there's definitely no title. I'm wondering if those cars would have to have a five-day hold, just old junkers sitting on your back 40.
You shouldn't be talking about Rukavina's yard that way.
County name names, but
County Attorney Choi.
Madam Chair, Representative Moline, right now, if the car does not have a title, there's requirements that are listed, and one of which would be that you'd have to sign under penalty of perjury that you do own the vehicle and there's no liens on the vehicle, and that the five-day hold provision would apply. Now, the industry has raised concerns about that issue as well, and we are working with the industry to address that. And again, by the time that this bill comes before you again and you have to vote on it, I believe that the industry will be supportive of whatever we come up with.
Representative Cornish.
Madam Chair, mine has to do with committee jurisdiction, but you and I can have that discussion offline.
Great.
Thank you.
Other questions from members? All right, seeing none, the chair renews her motion. That House File 1214 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Transportation. All those in, as amended, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion no. prevails. Thank you. County Attorney Choi, don't go far. Members, if you don't object, Representative Moline's going to quick chair this committee while I present my bill.
Representative Hillstrom moves House File 704 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. Representative Hillstrom, to your bill.
Thank you, members. House File 704 was brought to me by County Attorney Choi. Members, this bill has been around for 6 years, and this is setting up a process when children, when parents have had their rights terminated, and children have been languishing in foster care, establishing a procedure by which the parent and child can be reunified. With that, I'd like to turn it over to County Attorney Choi.
Mr. Choi.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, first of all, I want to thank Representative Hillstrom for bringing this legislation forward. This is something that is important to the County Attorney Association because we've been working on this compromise because I think it is time that we have a way in which, because today it's impossible for the situation being that if you're in foster care and you're about to age out of the system and never having been adopted, and the parent is willing and able and can be a parent again, I think in that particular situation there should be a process. And what is before you as a part of House File 704 creates that possibility. And this was something that it took a while for county attorneys to embrace because we were opposed to this legislation for a long period of time. And there's a lot of reasons to have concerns because, you know, when we take the extraordinary step of terminating a parent's right to be a parent, there are some really horrible and dark things that happen with respect to children. And we, you know, have to do that for the best interest of the child. But at the same time, the concept of justice in the child protection system is that I think that people can change. And if the child has never been adopted, I think the right thing to do is to allow for this to be a possibility. And so that's really what is before you, and I asked that you would support the bill.
Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Ron Elwood, Legal Aid. We've been working for, on this with department and county attorneys for a long time, and we are really appreciative of the bill before you and would urge your support.
That was Representative Hillstrom.
I was looking at Madam Chair, members, I have my apologies. I was looking at Representative Cortman and misstated your name, Chair Hillstrom. And I mean, Hillstrom, I apologize. I need more sleep.
I urge members to support the bill.
Is there anyone else from the audience that wants to be heard on the bill? Are there questions from members on the bill? Seeing none, Representative Hillstrom renews her motion that House File 704 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, motion prevails. Meeting is adjourned.